Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
The subject of the talk is a lawyer's defense of Christianity, and that seems bizarre in its own right. Lawyers and religion, or lawyers and morality, don't seem to come together very readily. All of you are acquainted with the plethora of lawyers' jokes. Some of them emphasize the disparity between law on the one hand and theology or morals on the other. There's the story of the lawyer, the clergyman, and the doctor who found themselves on a raft in shark-infested waters after their boat sank. The raft wasn't sufficient to hold them, and one of them would have to swim to shore nearby an island in order to get help. They cast lots. The lot fell to the lawyer. He jumped into the water, and the sharks focused in upon him. The clergyman began praying, and the physician covered his eyes. The two sharks, however, drew parallel with the lawyer, each put a fin under him, and deposited him safely on the shore. "A miracle," cried the clergyman. "Perhaps," said the doctor, "but in my opinion, it's mere professional courtesy." Lawyers are sharks. And then there's the boundary dispute between heaven and hell. You're probably aware of the fact that there is a fence between heaven and hell, and certain sections of the fence are to be repaired by the devil and other sections by the Lord. There's a covenant to repair. And the Lord is out one day and discovers that the fence is down in the devil's section. So he goes back to his office, he telephones, and informs the devil of this. The devil replies, nyah. The Lord says, "Now listen, you know the rules, you've got to repair that fence." Nyah. The Lord says, "All right, I'm going to sue." The devil begins laughing uproariously. The Lord says, "A lawsuit is never a laughing matter." "It is," says the devil, "when all the lawyers are over here." But in point of fact, very eminent lawyers and legal scholars have been serious believing Christians, and many of them have become such as a result of applying legal reasoning to the case for Christianity. I'll give you a few examples. Hugo Grotius, the founder of international law, called the father of international law, the author of De Jure Belli et Pacis, on the law of war and peace. He also did a work, De Veritate Religionis Christianae, on the truth of the Christian religion, a work which went through some 19 editions and was in print for two centuries. Selections from this are in a book of mine called The Jurisprudence Reader. Blackstone, Sir William Blackstone, the author of the first textbook of the common law. This work was virtually the center of legal instruction in England for a century. It was widely used in the United States, irritated Thomas Jefferson very much because of the Christian position of the author, and indeed it is said that one of the reasons that Jefferson founded the first resident law school in the United States was to get people off of reading Blackstone and on to a more secular approach to the law. Abraham Lincoln received his entire legal education by reading the Statutes of Indiana and Blackstone, and trust me, the Statutes of Indiana were not at all as helpful as Blackstone. At the beginning of Blackstone's commentary, he says, the source of law is God Almighty, revealed in Jesus Christ, and no human law ought to contradict the revelation as set forth. Look at the very beginning of Blackstone. That's the most relevant portion of the whole work today. Or coming to our own time, Sir Norman Anderson, the head of the School of Advanced Legal Studies at the University of London. He was knighted as the greatest representative of Muslim legal scholarship outside of the Muslim world. The man was a serious Christian believer, did several works in the defense of the Christian faith, and one pamphlet, I hold it up here, it is entitled The Evidence for the Resurrection, Sir Norman Anderson. Why is it that such eminent legal scholars and lawyers would move in the direction of Christian faith? Why, indeed, are we interested in lawyers looking at Christianity? Why not a dentist's defense of Christianity, for example? Well, the reason for this is that lawyers are concerned with evidence. Lawyers are in the evidence business. Theological seminaries and Bible schools do not teach courses in evidence. This is fairly evident from some of the sermons that you probably heard from the pulpit. But you can't get through a law school program without a course in evidence. What we're going to do here today is to look at certain special characteristics of legal evidence, and then we're going to apply those criteria to the central questions as to the truth of Christianity. Now, note the implications of this. Let's just suppose that applying the very same evidential tests that we use in the courts to Christianity vindicates the case for Christianity. Then one is faced with a very awkward choice. One could A, become a Christian, or B, one could dump the legal system. If one were to take the second of these alternatives, the results would be fairly traumatic, because legal systems exist to keep a society together. You know, there are only two ways, really, of solving intractable problems in society. One of these is a legal system. The other is what is known as self-help. Self-help. Let's say that the issue is, he stole my chicken. I did not steal his chicken. Well, you can litigate this. You can litigate this, and you can use principles of evidence to determine the situation. For example, was there a chicken? Was there a chicken? If there wasn't a chicken, this is actually a psychiatric problem rather than being a juridical problem. Right? But the other way of doing this is self-help. The person who thinks that the other person has stolen his chicken grabs that other person by the throat, inverts him and pounds him into the ground, and recovers the chicken. Difficulty with this is, of course, that perhaps the present possessor of the chicken is bigger and stronger, in which case he pounds the original owner into the ground and keeps the chicken. The end result of that sort of thing is chaos, bedlam, and anarchy. So legal systems develop to sublimate that sort of thing. And if a refined legal system ultimately arrives at methods of determining fact, it seems to me we ought to pay attention to those methods, even if they are applied in an uncomfortable realm like religion. It seems to me that the consequences are too great to ignore the application of legal evidence in an area like this. You may be interested to know that philosophers have been moving in the direction of the employment of legal evidence. Stephen Toulmin, in his work, The Uses of Argument, Stephen Toulmin says this, logic, we may say, is generalized jurisprudence. Arguments can be compared with lawsuits, and the claims we make and argue for in extra-legal contexts with claims made in the courts, while the cases we present in making good each kind of claim can be compared with each other. And Mortimer Adler, in a work dealing with the existence of God, says this, if I am able to say no more than a preponderance of reasons favor believing that God exists, I can say that I have advanced reasonable grounds for that belief. I am persuaded that God exists either beyond reasonable doubt or by a preponderance of reasons in favor of that conclusion over reasons against it. I am, therefore, willing to terminate this inquiry with the statement that I have reasonable grounds for affirming God's existence. Adler there uses the two standards of evidence that are employed in the common law, preponderance of evidence and to a moral certainty beyond reasonable doubt. The first is used in civil matters. The second, of course, in criminal matters. Since the criminal matters are far more serious, the standard of proof is that much higher. Now, you'll notice about the standard of evidence that we've been talking about, whether preponderance or beyond reasonable doubt, that these are probabilistic in nature. The law works with probabilities. In a civil action, if you can show that one side has 51% of the evidence and the other side has only 49% of the evidence, then the side with 51% wins. The probability there is simply in terms of a weighing or preponderance of evidence. In criminal matters, it's to a moral certainty beyond reasonable doubt, but it isn't to an absolute certainty. Moral certainty means beyond reasonable doubt. And a common law judge will help a jury by indicating what that means. The judge will say to the jury, you must find the defendant innocent unless, in examining the alternative explanations of the crime in terms of the admissible evidence, you find that there is some other reasonable way of explaining it. If there is any other reasonable way, in terms of the evidence that is admitted, to arrive at the conclusion as to how the crime was committed, other than that the defendant did it, you've got to let him off. You can only bring in a guilty verdict if there is no other reasonable explanation of the crime in terms of the admissible evidence. This is a probability style of reasoning, and it needs to be distinguished from mere possibility and absolute certainty. Why not absolute certainty? Because in matters of fact, you never can arrive at absolute certainty. The only areas where you can arrive at absolute certainty are areas of a purely formal nature. The analytical philosophers have done a good deal of work on this. It's only in the analytic realm, in the realm of pure logic, or pure mathematics, deductive logic or pure mathematics, or in the areas of tautology, that you can arrive at absolute certainty. And the reason you arrive at absolute certainty there is because you've defined it in to begin with. For example, all husbands are married. You can be absolutely certain of that. If anyone comes to your door doing a survey in the community to find out if all husbands are married, and they ask if in your household all the husbands are married, you throw the person out. The person is out of his head. You don't determine a thing like that by any sort of empirical investigation. If you know what husband means, for goodness sake, you know that they are all married by definition. But the law deals with facts, not with definitions. The law deals with matters of fact which need to be investigated. Why not mere possibility? Well, problem with mere possibility is that in a contingent universe, anything is possible. Anything is possible. I give you an illustration. The sheriff's deputies get a tip that a dreadful event has happened in the old mansion at Gopher Gulch. And they arrive there, and their worst suspicions are realized. There is a kind of Agatha Christie locked room situation there. And inside this, they find the victim cut into 18 equal-sized pieces, and the future accused holding a bloody axe. He is arrested, he is arraigned, and he is tried. It's a short trial because the evidence is so clean-cut. Excuse me, I couldn't resist that. And when the jury returns, the foreman asks for the verdict. The clerk of the court asks for the verdict from the foreman of the jury, and the foreman says, "We find the defendant innocent, Your Honor." Your Honor wakes up for the first time in the trial and insists on some sort of an explanation. Foreman says, "Your Honor, this is a contingent universe. In a contingent universe, anything is possible. Wouldn't you agree to this metaphysically?" The judge majored in agriculture, and so he's not quite sure of what's going on, but he eventually gets the point. And the foreman says, in light of the contingency of things, it's possible, isn't it, that invisible Martians entered the locked room, and with their laser guns, they cut the victim into 18 equal size pieces, and then because of their nasty temperaments, they made it look as if the accused did it. Now, in light of that genuine metaphysical possibility, we find the defendant innocent. Well, the judge would have apoplexy. He told these nincompoops when they went into the jury room that they were only to pay attention to the admissible evidence, to the evidence which had been admitted in the case, and they were to determine whether there was any other reasonable explanation in accord with that evidence. If you begin to think in terms of possibilities, then your whole universe crumbles. Why? Because the judge could be a Martian, so cleverly dressed in a judge's suit, that no one could tell the difference. Right? And what about your wife? I mean, suddenly the universe collapses before you. In dealing with matters of fact, we need to consider not absolute certainty, which is not available in the realm of absolute fact, or mere possibility, because anything is possible. So the law works in terms of probability. That's the standard of proof. Now, suppose we look at the relevant questions concerning the truth of Christianity by way of the probabilistic criteria that the law employs. What are the results? Well, what are the key questions, first of all? Christianity is a historical religion. It claims that God was incarnate, came to earth as a human being in Jesus Christ. He did this out of love because of the fact that we human beings have thoroughly messed up the human situation. We needed salvation. He came, died on the cross, and rose again from the dead in order to take care of that problem. His death on the cross was, as a substitute for us, an act of love, totally, something that wasn't necessary at all, but he did this for us in order to save us. And his resurrection from the dead, that vindicated and demonstrated that he had the power over nature and that he was the very person he claimed to be. Gigantic claims, staggering claims. How could one demonstrate those claims? How would it be possible to vindicate that sort of thing evidentially? Well, Jesus placed his emphasis upon his resurrection from the dead. He said, tear down this temple of my body, and in 3 days I will raise it again. And after his resurrection, we are told people believed that that was indeed the situation. Resurrection of Jesus Christ, therefore, is critical. And the resurrection of Jesus Christ can only be understood as veracious if there are sound witnesses to that fact having occurred. And since we are removed historically by centuries from this, it's vital that the historical records of what these witnesses have to say are reliable. What we're dealing with really are three factors. The documents that tell us about Jesus and what he claimed, the degree of reliability that can be attached to the witnesses who tell us about him and what he said in these documents, and finally, his resurrection from the dead as a vindication of his claims. Three things: the documents, the testimony, and the resurrection. If we can show on a balance of probability, or even better, to a moral certainty beyond reasonable doubt, that on those three counts the stuff is solid, then we have every ground to accept Christianity and what he's saying about salvation, both personally and societally. So, we want to look at those three considerations. Let's say something about the documents to begin with. Are the New Testament documents written by drunken monks in the 7th century? If they are, we are all in deep trouble if we think that we can sustain Christianity. In the law and in history, it is very, very important that documents derive from original sources, that they go back to the time of the original events, and that they have reached us in good condition. The transmission of these documents needs to be good, and the documents need to be original in character, coming from the time. Putting it in lawyers' terms, we've got to be sure that this stuff isn't a forgery, or that it is some kind of alteration of the original picture on the basis of later considerations. We can't go into great detail, and documents are not the most thrilling things in the world, obviously, but we can point out how two eminent lawyers have dealt with this. Some years ago, in London, a series of lectures was given at University of London, the Sarum Lectures, and these lectures in that particular year were entitled Roman Society and Roman Law in the New Testament. The author, an Oxford don by the name of A.N. Sherwin White, that's a hyphenated last name, Sherwin White. Hyphenated last names are fairly common in England. There was that very sad case of Jeffrey, the vicar stuttered when he was christened. It was a very sad instance. In any case, A.N. Sherwin White did these lectures using the New Testament as a basis for examining legal procedure in the first century, because there are a number of trial situations in the New Testament. And, of course, in the lectures, he then had to justify using the New Testament at all as a historical source, as a sound documentary source for his subject matter. And in a section of this work, he says, it seems very curious that liberal theologians, for example, critics of the New Testament, have difficulty with this. He says it's very curious. When one compares the case for the best-known contemporary of Christ, who, like Christ, is a well-documented figure, Tiberius Caesar. The story of his reign is known from four sources: the annals of Tacitus and the biography of Suetonius, written some 80 or 90 years later, the brief contemporary record of Valeius Patercolus, and the 3rd century history of Cassius Dio. These disagree amongst themselves in the wildest possible fashion, both in major matters of political action or motive, and in specific details of minor events. Everyone would admit that Tacitus is the best of all the sources, and yet no serious modern historian would accept at face value the majority of the statements of Tacitus about the motives of Tiberius. But this does not prevent the belief that the material of Tacitus can be used to write a history of Tiberius. His point being that the documents, as we have them in the New Testament, particularly the four Gospels having to do with Jesus, are far better attested as documents than the documents that we use with no difficulty whatsoever in regard to other figures of the classical world. He uses Tiberius Caesar as an example, four documents in the case of Tiberius Caesar, all of them later and with built-in prejudices that cause us considerable difficulties in certain respects. But we still build up our knowledge of the classical world that way. The point being that if you want to get rid of the documents of the New Testament, you can of course do this, but you first got to dump your knowledge of the classical world, at least any knowledge that derives from documentary sources. I had considerable contact with Lord Hailsham, who was twice Lord Chancellor. He became a Christian on the basis of the evidence for Christianity, examining it from a legal standpoint, and he outlines this in the first of his two autobiographies, the work entitled The Door Wherein I Went. In that work, he talks about the question of gospel forgeries. I read you just a brief section. What renders the argument invalid, the argument that the gospels are of that nature, is a fact about fakes of all kinds, which I learned myself in the course of a case in which there was a question of the authenticity of a painting purporting to be by Mogliani. This painting, as the result of my advice on evidence, was shown to be a fake. In the course of my researches, I was supplied by my instructing solicitor with a considerable bibliography dealing with the nature of fakes of all kinds and how to detect them. There was one point made which is of direct relevance to what we are discussing. Although fakes can often be made which confuse or actually deceive contemporaries of the faker, the experts or even the not-so-expert of a later age can invariably detect them, whether fraudulent or not, because the faker cannot fail to include stylistic or other material not obvious to contemporaries, because they are contemporaries, but which stand out a mile to later observers because they reflect the standards or the materials or the styles of a succeeding age to that of the author whose work is being faked. An illustration of this, do you remember the Hitler diaries, the so-called Hitler diaries of a decade ago? When the Hitler diaries were discovered in Germany, the Times sent a rationalistic, non-Christian Oxford historian, a very famous one, Hugh Trevor Roper, over to Germany to determine whether the documents were good. Trevor Roper looked at this stuff, and he wired back, "Pay anything, they're genuine." And the Times paid an arm and a leg, and of course, these were fraudulent. They were not the Hitler diaries at all. They were done by a very, very clever forger. Shortly after that, I was having lunch at Inner Temple with Lord Diplock, who at that time, before his decease, was the most distinguished member of the Judicial Committee of the House of Lords. And Diplock was a Christian, and he was laughing himself sick over this. He said, "Trevor Roper can't even detect a forgery in his own time. What makes him think he can do this for documents that are 2,000 years old?" It was Trevor Roper, of course, who has said on many occasions that the gospel records are really not worth much. They are the product of alteration, later changes, and the like. What we're saying is that a careful legal approach to the documents of the New Testament vindicate these documents. These documents would go in as admissible evidence under the ancient documents rule. All right? What about the testimony in these documents? You can have documents that are very early and well transmitted with numerous effective copies across the centuries and a careful textual criticism. You can have good documents, but the witnesses may be drunk and disorderly, the witnesses whose material appears in such documents. How do we know that the writers of the New Testament documents are, in fact, good witnesses who can be relied upon? Well, here, the legal rule is that documents are innocent until proven guilty, just as the defendant is innocent until proven guilty. The burden rests on the other side to impeach the veracity of the witness, this burden has to be discharged or the witnesses will be accepted. But, of course, the law has developed very, very sophisticated means of impeaching witnesses. And what we want to do, very briefly, is to apply those criteria to the witnesses that we have in the New Testament. And so if I can have the first of these esoteric diagrams. Yes. This is the famous Schoenberg construct, which is used as a device for impeaching witnesses. If you think that a witness is lying perverting the truth in one way or another, then there are four things you need to ask. There are four determinations that need to be made. You need to look at the witness himself or herself inside and outside, internally and externally. And you need to look at what the witness says, the actual testimony inside and outside. From an internal and external standpoint. The witness then has to be looked at in two ways, and the testimony, what the witness says, has to be looked at in two ways. Let's try that in the case of the gospel writers. Let's look at these witnesses themselves intrinsically. What does that mean? Is there anything about those witnesses that would make them natural-born liars? Do we have anything about them that would suggest that they should not be relied upon simply because of their characters? Do they have criminal records? Have they been under psychiatric help? Is there anything about them that would cause us to be suspicious of them? Doesn't seem to me that there is. These writers are ordinary people, and their writings seem to be very open and direct, even when they don't say very nice things about themselves or about the group with which they operate. For example, the second gospel was written by a companion of the Apostle Peter, and Peter is presented in that gospel as having a severe case of foot-in-the-mouth disease, and yet there is no effort made to doctor this material, apparently, to make Peter look any better. Intrinsically, they seem like good witnesses. But, of course, you can have a person who would not normally lie if the pressures are great enough, if the extrinsic social pressures are great enough. Suppose we look at those writers from that standpoint. Were there social pressures on the gospel writers and the witnesses that would have caused them to modify the picture of Jesus in the direction of his being more than he actually was? Well, actually, it was just the reverse. The pressures of the time, particularly in the religious situation that existed in Palestine, was such that the writers made very dangerous statements concerning Jesus, dangerous for themselves. Ultimately, Jesus ends up crucified for the position that he took, and those who present him as the truth put themselves under exactly those same dangers. But you say maybe Jesus himself influenced them not to tell things just as they were. Well, difficulty with that is that from the records we see that Jesus was against lying, dead against lying. He said of some of the religious leaders, they are of their father the devil. He was a liar from the beginning and so are they. So Jesus would certainly not have pushed these writers to anything but an accurate picture of what he did. Moreover, and we'll make this point very strongly in a few moments, moreover, if these writers had allowed themselves to be pressured into telling something other than the truth, they never would have gotten away with it because these materials were in circulation while hostile witnesses of the same events were still alive. That's a very, very powerful consideration. Let's look at what they say. What about the material in the Gospels? Is the material self-contradictory? Is it internally erroneous? Well, the four Gospels don't say exactly the same thing. But you know, that's a mark of truth, not the other way around. If there's anything I like, it's to have three police witnesses get on the stand and say exactly the same thing. This is absolutely wonderful. And of course, we all know what happened. One of them took notes, then all three got together and rehearsed the thing. That's collusion. The really dangerous situation for a trial lawyer is to have, say, three witnesses to a traffic accident, and they don't seem to be saying the same thing. Why? Because they're each looking at the events from three different angles. But when you penetrate into what they're saying, they end up saying exactly the same thing. They corroborate each other, and that's the situation you have with the gospel writers. The people who say, look at the contradictions in this stuff, generally don't know what a contradiction is. A contradiction means two statements which cannot both be true under the same conditions at the same time. Now, the Gospels will present diverse approaches to the same event, but that's not the same thing as a contradiction. And writers can put in something or not put in something. You don't have the choice of material exactly the same in the case of the four gospel writers. Example, Jesus is said to have cleaned out the temple at one end of his ministry in the first three gospels, and in the fourth gospel, he cleans out the temple at the other end of his ministry. Is that a contradiction? Surely not, unless it said he did it once and only once. He cleaned it out at the beginning. He cleaned it out at the end. And considering the condition of the temple, it's perfectly remarkable he didn't do it every Saturday night. Suppose we look at the testimony extrinsically in terms of other documents of the ancient world and archaeological evidence. Does the material fit? Or are there contradictions between the material on the one hand and extrinsic evidence on the other? Well, we have very few contemporary records. We certainly have no other primary records concerning Jesus, because the early church collected the primary records, and those are the ones that went into the New Testament. But we have archaeological confirmation of New Testament material, and the liberal and critical theologians have had a lot of problems with this, because archaeology keeps confirming the New Testament and disconfirming the liberal speculations. One example, 50 years ago, liberal theologians, the equivalent at that time of the Jesus Seminar today, said that probably the gospel writers had invented Pontius Pilate. There probably had never been a person by the name of Pontius Pilate. It was simply to reinforce the narrative. And then in 1961, archaeologists at Caesarea Philippi turn up a monumental inscription, a portion of a building, and lo and behold, there is Pilate's name and his position carved into it. The fact of the matter is that that archaeology has been the best friend the New Testament has had, and we have no reason to disconfirm the New Testament material on that basis either. So if you look at the gospel materials in terms of all four of these criteria, they can't be impeached. The stuff would go in, and it would go in a weighty fashion. Can I have that changed for me? A trial attorney by the name of Givens wanted to help young advocates in cross-examination. Cross-examination is a frightening thing to do, and he wanted to help young advocates to see that catching people lying is not that difficult. Here is ordinary, truthful communication. An event occurs, it's remembered, a portion is selected to be communicated, a symbol is chosen, this is generally words, although on the Italian autostrada, if you pass an Italian in that center lane, the symbol will be something like this. I won't give you the interpretation of that, but in any case, there is finally the interpretation by the listeners. All right? Now, put on the next slide. Here's what happens when lying occurs. First thing to note, the complexity of it. The complexity of it. The first two boxes and the last three boxes are exactly the same as in the other diagram. Everything else is added when prevarication takes place. An event occurs, there's an original recollection of it, and then, we'll say, the witness chooses to distort. All right? So, he picks a distortion. The minute he does this, he becomes a juggler. He becomes a juggler. He has to have three balls in the air simultaneously. To the left, he has to compare what he's saying to what the person he's talking to already knows. Secondly, he has to remember what he said previously and make sure that those don't conflict. Liars have to have good memories. And thirdly, to the far right, he has to compare what he's saying with what can be discovered by checking it out. And all three of these balls must be in the air at the same time. On the basis of this, he estimates his chance of discovery and makes an existential decision whether to continue with or revise his original story. And every time he changes the story, the number of balls in the air multiplies geometrically, not arithmetically. And then there is the selection of material to communicate, etc. The point of this is that it's not difficult to catch people lying. Now, you may say, but after all, the New Testament writers and the witnesses to Jesus were not subjected to cross-examination in a structured courtroom situation. Of course they weren't. But as F.F. Bruce of the University of Manchester, the New Testament scholar, pointed out on several occasions, the presence of hostile witnesses who had seen those same events and who had had contact with Jesus and who were still alive while this stuff was circulating, those people constituted the functional equivalent of cross-examination. They had the means, the motive, and the opportunity to blow the whistle on any alterations in the life of Christ by these witnesses. They had the means because they had been there themselves and seen the events. They had the motive They wanted to destroy Christianity. They had brought about the end of Jesus' earthly life, and they had the opportunity because those Jewish religious leaders were leaders of the community in which the early witnesses presented their testimony and circulated their material. So, as far as the witnesses are concerned, we do not have a problem. Now, of course, all we've gotten to at this juncture is solid documents and good witnesses who tell us that Jesus claimed to be the divine Messiah, God come to earth to die for the sins of the world. The fact that he claimed it doesn't prove it. You've got other people in history who have made grandiose claims. To make a claim is not, of course, to confirm a claim. Anybody can sue. You've got a constitutional right to sue in this country, but that doesn't mean you're going to win. To win means you've got to have the evidence on your side. The story is told of the young fellow who went to the psychiatric hospital and to do some training. And he went in and he saw this person with a three-cornered hat, and his hand in his coat, and having a good idea but wanting to be nice. He said, "And who are you?" The man said, "Napoleon, bien sûr." Napoleon, of course. The intern said, "Well, what makes you think that?" And the man said, "God told me." And a voice from the other side of the room, "I did not." So, merely claiming to be God is not the same thing as being God, and some of the people who have made claims of this sort probably should be right where that particular individual was. How do we know that Jesus' claims are solid? Well, the resurrection is the means by which you can arrive at that. There are other ways of arriving at it, by the way. There are innumerable prophecies of the Old Testament, highly specific ones which are fulfilled in the life of Jesus in the first century. That sort of thing can be checked out. But if you want one single point of focus, the resurrection is certainly that point. And what do we discover about the resurrection? Well, first of all, that it involves detailed appearances over a 40-day period to a wide variety of people. Writing in 56 A.D., Paul says, gives the gospel, that which was delivered unto me, how that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried and he rose again the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and was seen by, and then there he lists a whole number of witnesses, and finally he says, and to over 500 others, most of whom remain alive to the present. Point being, if you don't think this happened, for goodness sake, ask some of the people who were there. There's no trouble in this. And he says when he's making his defense before Agrippa and Festus in the 26th chapter of Acts, he says, this thing was not done in a corner. You know these things are true. This is the sort of thing for which one could investigate directly. This is very, very powerful. But lawyers would go even beyond that. In a work entitled Who Moved the Stone, a gentleman by the name of Morrison a generation ago pointed out that if you don't think the resurrection occurred, you're going to have to explain the missing body on Easter morning. It's a classic missing body case, as it were. Now, who would have taken the body? Well, there are only three interest groups in this situation. There are the Romans, the Jewish religious leaders, and the disciples. Surely the Romans and the Jewish religious leaders aren't going to steal the body. It's against their interest. The Romans are trying to keep things quiet so as to collect taxes, and that's the reason that Pilate was willing to have an innocent man crucified just to keep the crowds happy. The Jewish religious leaders were so concerned that not even a rumor gets started about the resurrection that they had a guard put on the tomb by the Romans. They're not going to steal the body. What about the disciples? Well, if the disciples stole the body, then they went out and preached something they knew to be untrue, and they died for it. Now, people have died for a lot of things through the centuries. They've died for a lot of lame-brained and false things through the centuries. But if they die for these things, they believe them to be true. People do not go out and die for what they know already to be untrue. That is psychologically out. And if you eliminate all three of these groups, what are you left with? You're left with the primary evidence, the primary witnesses who saw Jesus over this 40-day period. Incidentally, these instances are not sort of mystical instances of the kind you get in the history of some religions and sects. Jesus eats fish with his disciples after the resurrection. I've done two books on the occult. I never came across a fish-eating ghost. Not one. Apparently, ghosts, you know, don't like fish. Maybe it's the absence of tummy or something of that sort. I'm not quite sure. But cuisine au poisson is not exactly along the line of the ghost. These appearances are of such specificity that it would take a remarkable imagination to develop them. And as we've seen, the stuff is in circulation while the contemporaries are still there. But you say, isn't it possible that there's another explanation? For example, what about Schoenberg's notion of the Passover plot? Not Schoenberg, but someone help me. Yes, exactly. What about that? It was the argument in the Passover plot that Jesus was really a creature from outer space who, of course, had powers the ordinary human being doesn't have. Well, isn't that possible? Sure it's possible. Metaphysically, anything is possible. But remember our locked room and the fellow cut into 18 equal-sized pieces. In no court of law can you gratuitously introduce an explanation like that. There is no first-hand information whatsoever, no first-hand witness who gives any material that would assist a hypothesis of that sort. Nobody sees Jesus coming out of a spacecraft. Or anything of the sort. You can't just gratuitously introduce explanations of events. You've got to stick with the admissible evidence, stick with the reasonable evidence, and draw reasonable conclusions from that evidence. Well, where does this leave us? If there is solid evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, then Jesus was able to conquer death, and he offers salvation to anyone who will acknowledge that he needs it, and he needs what Jesus has done for him. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. And the reason for this, of course, is that only he has achieved this salvation for us out of the Father's love. Putting it shortly, you'll never get a better reason to worship than you get right there. Death is a absurd problem for us. Death cuts into our lives without any warning. It destroys the best things that we may want to do, and it creates the greatest tragedies. If Jesus is really able to do this, then admitting, acknowledging who he is certainly the very best thing that one could possibly do. And it's very interesting to me that so many lawyers who have checked this out have come to exactly that conclusion. I'm going to read just two brief quotations in conclusion. The first of these is from great 19th century specialist on evidence, Simon Greenleaf. And the second one is from Pascal. First of all, Simon Greenleaf. All that Christianity asks of men on this subject is that they would be consistent with themselves and that they would treat its evidences as they treat the evidence of other things, and that they would try and judge its actors and witnesses as they deal with their fellow men when testifying in human affairs and actions, in human tribunals. Let the witnesses be compared with themselves, with each other, and with surrounding facts and circumstances, and let their testimony be sifted as if it were given in a court of justice on the side of the adverse party, the witness being subjected to a rigorous cross-examination. The result, it is confidently believed, will be an undoubting conviction of their integrity, ability, and truth. the greatest authority on common law evidence in the world in the 19th century, wrote a work entitled The Testimony of the Evangelist, in which he did this. He put the gospel writers, as it were, on the witness stand, and his conclusion is, this is the route to take. Pascal, scientist, theologian, apologist of the 17th century. In the Pensée, in the thoughts, number 430, il y a assez de lumière pour ceux qui ne désirent que de voir et assez d'obscurité pour ceux qui ont une disposition contraire. There is enough light for those who want to see, and there's also enough obscurity for those who have a contrary disposition. This is the principle of probability. If you want to get out from under this case, you can do it. You can do it. You can find some way to get out from under it, because the case is not 100%. But the case is so strong that if you use the same kind of reasoning and judgment that you do in ordinary life to make the most critical decisions in your life, and you apply it here, you'll accept the truth of Christianity. What Pascal is saying there is, the reason people reject Jesus Christ is not a question of evidence. They reject Jesus Christ for other reasons that have nothing to do with evidence. For example, if you accept him, you no longer are the Lord of your own life, and therefore you're going to be within a frame of reference that he creates. For some people, that's pretty ghastly. Why? Because, as one wag has said, God created us in his image, and ever since we've been returning the compliment. What we really want to do is to make ourselves gods instead of going to the true God and accepting what he's done for us. The fact of the matter is that it isn't all that ghastly. If you accept the true God, you get the best value system that's ever been made available. You get the presence of that God in your heart so that your life can be changed, and you get eternal life. This is not bad as an opportunity. And if you think that this puts you in a structure of legalism, it hardly does that. St. Augustine, love God and do as you please. Because, of course, when you love him, what you do is going to be what pleases him, because you're going to want to do what pleases him. All right, a lawyer's defense of Christianity. I have gotten to the end of our time. I understand that there are some people who are ascetic and don't eat and therefore would like to stay on and ask some questions. That's perfectly all right if you'd like to do that. And I believe that there's an announcement to the effect that in the taping people can come over. I don't know the details of all this, but now I turn this back to the chairman. Yes, sir. How do I know? I'm. I only do what they tell me.
I'm David Feinberg, and there's some things that you brought up that I see as commonly used before as straw men to set up proof of the gospel. I wanted to ask what you thought. First of all, when you began by saying, you either have to believe in Christianity or get rid of the basis for a legal system. It seems there's a lot of Jewish lawyers, a lot of people that are obedient to the laws of the land that have nothing to do with Jesus. And in fact, Jesus didn't teach anything new that wasn't already in the law and interpreted by the prophets in the Jewish scriptures. And so that's one of them there. And in fact, Jesus even taught things contrary to law as far as turning the other cheek. If someone asks you for something, you must give it to them. Walking the extra mile. Our legal system doesn't establish these things.
Are those contrary to the law, just out of curiosity? I mean, if you do turn the other cheek, do you get arrested?
No, but I mean, the law doesn't say you have to do that.
Right.
Jesus says you do.
Right. Of course, I think neither of us would feel that everything Jesus said was to be codified as law, right? So the real question is whether what he said is contrary to ultimate moral law, not whether under certain social conditions one would either get jailed or not for it.
Well, my point is there's a lot of people that have nothing to do with Christianity that still abide,
sure,
and honor the law.
Sure, quite right.
Jewish people.
Quite right. Quite right.
The next one would be as far as using the scripture to prove itself. I mean, you say that there's these hostile witnesses at the time. There's 500 witnesses of the resurrection. Mm-hmm. I mean, where are these people? What are their names? Where are their affidavits? I mean, using the scripture and saying, well, this is true, and therefore the truth of it proves itself. I mean, I don't know if you can do that in a court of law. How do we know this wasn't written hundreds of years later? Anything that disagreed with it, they wouldn't have put in the Bible. And so there's that one. And also the fact that if you don't believe in Jesus and the scriptures, because there's so many copies of it, just because someone prints up many copies of propaganda doesn't make it true. You say you have to get rid of what we know about Plato and Caesar. Well, I mean, Plato and Caesar didn't come out and say, if you don't believe in this, you're going to go to hell. I mean, so what difference does it make whether Plato or Caesar lived or not? But there's a huge difference whether
so
Jesus
you're lived willing or not. To get rid of anybody who doesn't say you'll go to hell otherwise.
I beg your pardon?
I said you're willing to get rid of any historical figures that don't say
yeah,
that you'll
well,
go
yeah,
to hell
I'm
otherwise.
Saying it's not important. I mean, it's an interesting story, but whether Plato lived or it's a legend, what difference does it make? There's a huge difference in what the Christian
you're,
claims.
You're not taking a history degree here at the university, I take it.
No,
I didn't think so. Yeah.
So anyway, those are the three straw men that I see commonly set up, you know, to prove the scripture, using it to prove itself, and also saying you have to get rid of these other guys if you get rid of this. But these other guys aren't making the same claim that this is an important. You have to change your life.
Okay, let me comment on both of those things. First of all, we're not using circular reasoning where we start out with the assumption that the New Testament documents are scripture. And then we are coming to the conclusion that these documents are scripture. It's not that at all. What we're doing is treating the New Testament documents as one treats any historical documents, and we are drawing certain conclusions from those documents. The confusing thing about this, and you're perfectly right to be a bit confused on this, problem comes from the fact that these documents are now in beautiful India paper editions with verse numbers, and Aunt Tilly will not allow you to put flowers on top of the copy of the New Testament you have. And so we get the idea that the only way to deal with this stuff is to deal with it as a kind of sacred book, right? Now, as a matter of fact, if we had enough time, we could move on beyond what I was doing today and show that this stuff is a lot more than just good historical material. But I haven't done that here, and that, in any case, would be a consequence of this reasoning. It wouldn't be a presupposition, a kind of starting point, a hidden starting point for doing it. We're simply taking these documents as you would take the other documents of the classical world. Now, you're also perfectly correct that there is a great difference in the consequences of rejecting the claims of Jesus, for example, as compared with the claims of Plato or other classical figures. There's no doubt about that. But I think we've got to be very careful and not develop a separate set of historical criteria according to the consequences that the event would have were it to be true. If we did that, notice, each nation would have its own set of historical criteria because there are certain historical events that are very important to one nation and not as important to another. Thus, for example, for the French to admit that Napoleon lost at Waterloo would require a completely different and immensely more rigorous set of historical criteria than for the Chinese, because the Chinese don't care who won and who lost at Waterloo, presumably. So this is why historians don't develop different sets of criteria according to the implications of the given event. I think we've got to try to separate these two things. First, try to determine if the thing did happen and if it's solid. And if it does, if that's the case, then no matter how traumatic the consequences of accepting it are, it seems to me rationally we need to go in that direction.
Providing they're true.
Yeah, as I say, we check them out. If they're true, then the consequences follow, even if the consequences are not what we would expect or not what our own cultural background would lead us to do. And incidentally, your other point, I should add this as well, your point about a lot of people following the law without being Christian. Of course, there's no doubt about that whatsoever. People follow the law in many instances simply because, as we said at the beginning, if you don't follow a structure of law, your society collapses into self-help and anarchy. For goodness sake. So we're not saying that one has to become a Christian in order to follow the law. What we're saying is that legal evidence can help in making the decision as to whether one ought to accept Christianity. Okay? Somebody else? Very good questions, by the way. Good stuff. Yes.
One comment about which sort of refers back to this previous comparing the claims of Jesus with, say, the claims of a philosopher at that time is that for historical evidence, there is a different rules of evidence in the sense that as the probability of the event goes down, the required evidence goes up. For example, in terms of history now.
Incidentally, I don't agree with that at all.
Okay, well, let me give you an example. If I go home tonight and say, I saw Sam Burke at the faculty club, my wife will say, oh, fine, how's his family? Because I see Sam Burke at the faculty club very often. If I said I saw Lois Capps, our representative, having lunch at the faculty club, she'd probably say, how did you know it was Lois Capps? Or ask a little more pushing, just a little bit, that I've made sure. But she'd probably accept that pretty easily because I know Lois Capps personally and she's on campus frequently. So, but if I saw it, I said...
You
I
said
saw
it was Bo Clinton. Derrick. You said I saw Bo Derrick at the faculty.
Yeah, group. Well, if yes. I said, right. Yeah. But what if I saw Bill Clinton walking across campus, then she starts saying, well, I didn't hear about that in the news. I'm sure that would have... You know, what's your evidence? You've got to have more and more evidence as the probability of the event goes down and down.
Okay. As I said, interrupting you in the middle of your question, I don't agree with that at all. The correctness of what you're saying is that where something out of the ordinary is involved, people will very definitely ask more acute questions. Your wife will ask questions about Bill Clinton's presence that she wouldn't for someone that you see at the faculty club any day. But the method of determining whether or not A, B, or C are at the faculty club, that method is exactly the same. It's exactly the same. And it is not a matter David Hume, who argued against all miracles, David Hume argues that the probability of a miracle occurring would be so low that it wouldn't even be worth investigating it, for goodness sake. Because any unique event, do you see, would require an infinite amount of evidence to take care of it. Of course, the trouble with that reasoning is that it's based upon the assumption that we know cosmically what is probable and what is improbable. Cosmically, we know which events can occur, which events can't occur. But listen, in an Einsteinian relativistic universe, we are not in a position to evaluate the possibility or impossibility of events against any kind of criterion. Back in the days absolutistic natural law understanding, we could say, my goodness, if this violates the laws of the universe as we know them, then of course the event can't occur. But now we realize that we build up these natural laws empirically by observation. And we are not in any sense in a position to be able to say that an event is excluded by the structure of law that we have. And in science, may I give you an illustration? You're a chemist, is that right? Okay, do you remember Neil Bartlett's discovery of the possibility of combining inert gases? Huh? Didn't he do xenon heptafluoride? Yeah, all right. The fact of the matter is that that could have been done for 75 years. And the reason that nobody even tried to do it was because of the aesthetic elegance of the periodic table. The idea was that all of those inert gases had their outer electron rings just stuffed to their little gullets, right? And therefore they were bachelors. They were not going to get married with another element and so forth. We were so mesmerized by our structure that we didn't even bother to check it out. And once it was experimentally attempted, it was possible. We have to revise our structures in terms of the particular facts, and we can't set up ahead of time a whole set of criteria that make it highly unlikely that we're going to discover anything different from anything else. And you know, all historical events are unique. All of them are. History, as far as we know, is unrepeatable. Huh? And so are we going to demand an infinite amount of evidence for Napoleon losing the Battle of Waterloo simply because this is never able to be repeated under laboratory conditions? We've got to... No historian operates that way. And all we're asking is that when it comes to this issue of Jesus Christ, that's the way we go about it as well. Yes.
Also relating to this gentleman's question, would you agree, I think a famous theologian has said, all things are possible except squeezing toothpaste back into the tube.
I have heard that,
I think
yes.
That was yourself. But that would you agree that we look at these as ordinary historical documents, and in those ordinary historical documents we find a claim by Jesus that he is God come in the flesh, and we find eyewitnesses or close associates who give the evidences that we saw him, we ate with him, we conversed with him over a 40-day period, and these eyewitnesses then proceeded to go to their death for sharing this evidence, what had happened in their lives, and that these, from these ordinary historical documents, Jesus proves that he is who he claims to be, that he is God come in the flesh, that therefore it's not circular, but that it's based on the evidence that a reasonable court of law...
I was trying to say exactly that, and I appreciate your summarizing it. Yes, yes. That's just exactly what I was trying to say. May I say that this seems a very restrained group to me. I wonder if this is... this is in California. I mean, I really expected to see more dynamism and liveliness. People seem if anything, zonked. I think that's the technical term, zonked. Is this because are you near examinations? Is it that this is a trough between Thanksgiving and Christmas? Or is it perhaps the room? The room intimidates you and it becomes difficult for you to relax and deal with it. I'm just curious. Go ahead. You don't have to answer that. You can pose your own question.
One of my professors made the point this quarter that about the birth of Jesus and saying that Christians weren't as interested in being as reliable about his birth as they were about his death. And he said that the story about Herod and the story of Jesus' birth, time-wise, Herod occurred around 6 B.C. and Jesus' birth was 4 B.C. And he said that they kind of combined these two. I was wondering if you'd heard that statement before, or how, if you have, or if not, like what evidence you could have about that, because I'd like to see a way I could respond to it.
Yeah, well, you should go to a good New Testament commentary, for example, the New International Commentary, New International Commentary in the New Testament, the volumes dealing with Matthew 1 and Luke 1, those are the birth narratives, and you will see that it is perfectly possible to reconcile the Herod dating with what you have in the New Testament. The wise men, the magi, did not arrive conveniently for the makers of these little creche sets at Christmas time. They were actually not there at the same time as the shepherds. All right. So what we do, we go into these birth things on the basis of a lot of medieval tradition as to the alignment of the stuff. But if you take just what is there in the Matthew and Luke accounts, there isn't any problem with this. And incidentally, there's no indication within the records that the writers are more interested in death than in birth or anything like that. It's the same writers who give you all this stuff. And the material dealing with the virgin birth, for example, is being given by people who had obviously contact with Mary. It's just inconceivable that they could have pulled off a midrashim sort of interpretation of this stuff. There are people today, some liberal theologians, who argue that this is a midrash. It is a typological story created along the lines of certain of a certain literary style employed by Jewish contemporaries. But the writers don't indicate this at all. The writers indicate this as factual. And the fascinating thing is that they insist upon linking this into ordinary history. They go overboard. In the days of Caesar Augustus, a decree went out that all the world should be taxed. And the taxing occurred when Cyrenius was governor of Syria. And so this is not once upon a time. They are attempting to get across to you that this is factual history. And it seems to me that we need to take them seriously when they endeavor to do this. If you have other grounds, if you had better contemporary evidence that this wasn't historical, that would be one thing. But in the absence of that, it seems to me one needs to go along with it. And if this case for the resurrection, as I presented it, is as strong as I think it is, then it isn't strange, is it, that Jesus arrives on the scene in a little different manner from the average birth. One other little point on this. If you go to the Revised Standard Version of the prophecy of this in the Old Testament, Isaiah 7:14, it says, a young woman shall conceive, and then there's a footnote saying the word can also mean virgin. Well, it's interesting that the Hebrew word, alma, in the Old Testament there, can mean both. But when the Jews themselves translated the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek, producing the Septuagint, this was done in Alexandria for Greek-speaking Jews, 300 to 100 B.C., they translated that by the Greek word parthenos, which means virgin and only virgin. And that's the word which is employed in the New Testament on this. So before this became a matter of controversy in the first century, the Jews themselves thought that this was a prediction of a virgin birth. Now, whoever's in charge of this needs to cut this off at the appropriate time, but certainly not before your question. You were on your feet before I even completed that sentence.
Okay, so this may actually be pretty much the same as his question, because I'm not sure I understood your...
Well, I could repeat the very same answer a second time, if you'd like.
Oh, well, it's actually... Let me try repeating it and see if you have the same answer.
Okay.
But it seemed to me that you were essentially saying that you wouldn't require more evidence for an event which seems extraordinary or far out of our common experience. And it doesn't seem that that's the standard of reasoning that I would expect anyone to use in law or history or everyday life. I would think that if I hear a story about Julius Caesar leading an army or eating a sandwich, I would say, okay, that seems reasonable. But if I hear a story about Julius Caesar flying or performing miracles, I would expect much more evidence for that. And in a similar note, you were saying that you wouldn't believe the story about the guy whose wife or friend was cut up into 18 pieces by Martians. But that's similarly because it's an extraordinary event that's out of our common experience. If me and the other members of the jury see Martians coming down every day and cutting up people, I would believe the story and say, oh, it's those pesky Martians again. They do that all the time.
Well, see, the issue here is whether you rely upon evidence or whether you don't, that's the Martian situation. In my hypothetical example, there is no evidence whatsoever for the Martians. If there were evidence for the Martians, then we would evaluate that. But our evidential technique is the same regardless of the uniqueness of the event we're talking about. It has to be. There isn't a gamut of 25 different approaches to verifying facts, running from the ones that are really surprising to the ones that are ordinary. The very same techniques are used. The difference is, of course, that if the event is really surprising, we're going to be sure to apply those methods, right? And we're going to apply them carefully. But they are exactly the same methods that we would apply if we wanted to go to the trouble of verifying the ordinary event, the event in one's ordinary experience. We don't have a series of techniques depending upon the seriousness of the event or the claim. And the reason we don't is that we don't know the universe well enough, really, to be able to establish likelihood or unlikelihood in a metaphysical or cosmic sense. That's the point. You don't want to get like the old farmer who had seen cows and chickens and ducks And then he was taken to the zoo in the city, and there was a giraffe. It was totally outside of his experience. He looked at the thing, he looked again, he said, "There ain't no such animal." I mean, in the face of such a, in the face of the surprising, you can do one of two things. You can either check the surprising out very, very carefully using the very same techniques that you determine anything by, or you can refuse to enlarge your experience and insist upon that event's not happening at all. And the people who argue against the miraculous, like David Hume or Kay Nielsen or contemporary atheistic arguments against the miraculous, always assume that they already have a structure of understanding of the universe which can be depended upon to range events, and then finally we get to events that are really surprising and those you don't even have to investigate at all. This is exactly the Humean argument. Hume said we have uniform experience against the miraculous because any miracle is unique. So uniform experience exists against it. So anytime anybody comes to me and says, a miracle has occurred, I ask myself, would it be more miraculous for the event to occur or more miraculous for this person to be lying or mistaken? And it's always more miraculous in the one case, so you never have to investigate these. That is the closed view of the world, which we cannot maintain scientifically or philosophically anymore, and therefore if we're faced with a claim like this, we've got to check it out. We really do. And you can't say ahead of time that any event doesn't take place. But the technique you use to investigate it is going to be the same technique that you use for investigating any other event.
So without ruling out Martians or collapsing ceilings a priori, aren't you more inclined to believe a story? You know, if this guy tells you a consistent story about a collapsing ceiling, aren't you more inclined to believe that than a consistent story about Martians?
My inclination to believe is irrelevant. I might certainly be more inclined to believe it, but the extent to which I am going to deal scientifically, rationally, and juridically with this, I'm going to have to check it out. And until I check it out, I got no right to draw any conclusions whatsoever. I really don't. Now, for practical purposes, of course, you know, if somebody who seems to have a screw loose somewhere comes up to my door and says that he's followed by invisible Albanians and that sort of thing, I'm probably not going to bother to check it out. But the reason for that is simply that he's probably interrupting my watching of ALF reruns on television or other really important things I'm doing. Okay? But if this is a serious claim and it needs to be investigated, I'm going to have to investigate it the very same way I would anything else.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.